are back with episode 427 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and somewhere in some timeline, I think Hari Seldon is smiling right now.
And don't you hate it, this is Gary, and don't you hate it when your friends won't help you no matter how much they say they will, and they just bail on you?
And this is Brunslum from Australia, and normally when I talk about shows and say, enough with the Christ-like metaphors, this isn't quite what I mean.
That could reply to so many shows, unfortunately, but...
Yes.
That's literally this week.
You guys know me, you probably know what I'm specifically referring to, but...
Yeah, most likely, but it'll be funny when we can refer to it in other places, too. At any rate, we are obviously back in business, and if those of you have been going over to the VogNetwork.com website, you'll have noticed that there is an entire quote-unquote wing of the website now that is devoted to TV reviews that we are helping to contribute. So, we're kind of getting our feet back on the ground where they belong. I know that Edmund has contributed at least a person of interest so far. We've got Henry back in the game. I've been back in the game. I'm hoping to rope Bronstein back in the game soon. Hoping. And then
I should have some stuff coming soon.
Excellent. And so we're like I said, back in business. So please go on over there, give them lots of support. As I've said, one of the really cool things that you can do now is not only can you give your comments for a review, but you can actually add a concurring or dissenting opinion with your own score for the episode. So if you do that, and it's before we start talking about it here on the show, then I'll actually try to start incorporating some of that into the overall scoring. So you'll have your little part in determining what each season's aggregate average score will be as for a given show. So, it's our little way of letting you participate in the Vogue spirit in this whole process. But what can I say? Lots of stuff going on over there. And, I guess it's time then for a disclaimer. Edmund, why don't you do that?
Absolutely. We like to discuss just about anything that might have happened in these episodes, so you must be warned that you will most likely be spoiled if you haven't seen them yet. But it's usually a week or so before we do that, so we certainly hope you've caught up by now.
That's right. And, well, let's see. For our first topic, let's go ahead and... Bronstein, why don't you jump in and say what you want to start us off with?
Give the more dramatic cliffhangers of the past few weeks, I'm going to go with Hannibal.
Okay, and here's the promo.
If you never catch the Ripper, he won't be caught. If you want him, you will have to kill him.
Fair enough. You killed the bailiff during my trial.
I thought it would exonerate you.
And the judge?
Imagine if we started working together.
I need a favor. I want you to kill Hannibal Lecter.
NBC's Hannibal is all new next Friday.
On an all-new Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon, Kevin Bacon drops by NBC Tonight.
All right, and Bronstein, if you could give the recap, and apologies to everyone for any lag or otherwise we get. We know that Google has been a little bit touchy lately, but go ahead.
Okay, Hannibal Season 2, Episode 5, Mugazuki? Yeah, but I don't know. Will makes claims about the Ripper's true identity. Dr. Abel Gideon arrives to confirm Will's suspicions, leading to a plan to put an end to the Ripper once and for all. Square, Will enlists Freddy's help to contact his lethal admirer, and Alana becomes suspicious of Will's intentions. And I gave this one a 10 out of 10.
Ooh. And you, Mr. Edmund?
Yes, it was very, very good. I think I will actually, I'll go with a 9.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, Bronstein, explain the 10.
Basically, the previous episode I thought was quite strong, but the thing that really stuck out about it was that cliffhanger. Well, not even really a cliffhanger, because Brian Fuller made sort of very clear later that it wasn't meant to be ambiguous. It was supposed to be, yes, this is what happened to that character. And just in case you were worried about it, this episode pretty much opened with a lot of detail on an exploration of the death of a member of the main cast, a death that should be at least surprising, given that there's a character who appeared Dragon, the which is the events of which are supposed to take place a couple of seasons down the line in the show. So it's dramatic for the audience, and then it just got taken beyond by the reaction of all these characters, just seeing how they follow up. Just the fact that the immediate thing we go to following the end of the episode, Hannibal looks like he's about to kill a member of the main cast, and then what's he doing at the beginning of this episode? You guessed it, yeah. Cooking!
yummy.
As is his wont. And yeah, this was, as sort of murders on this show go, would be more gruesome and at the same time aesthetically interesting and visually stunning murder scenes, murder tablets that we've seen in the show so far. This museum-esque dissection. This you know, and in a very Hannibal fashion, you know, specifically Hannibal the character, this thing that is at once mocking and honoring his victim. And those reactions and all the great performances, all those moments would have been like a really, really strong thing to focus the show on. But then it just sort of moves on into Will Graham having been locked up. He's trying to, he's been trying to outwit people. He's been trying to get people on side. He's had his only ally yanked out from under the rug, so that he's in a bad place. And we see him start going down a very dark road by basically actively plotting to become the kind of person that he's in the state hospital for, they think he already is. And to do that, the notion of the way he's manipulating the media and Freddie Lowndes and his communication with sort of other killers and stuff like that was all very evocative of the source material. For those who haven't read the novel Red Dragon or seen either of the film adaptations, it was sort of a big thing that the three main characters were Will Graham and Hannibal Lecter and the serial killer that Graham's hunting, and the fact that there is this very strange interplay between the three, even though one of them is in prison and theoretically not really able to do much chit-chatting with people, and nonetheless he not only is able to sort of communicate with people and get under their skin, he becomes a major player in the way that the story unfolds. And in continuing with the season's twisting of what people know of the sort of mythology, for lack of a better word, it's Graham who's behind bars. He's the one who's having to be manipulative and sort of stretch out his influence from behind bars, and he's falling more and more into the role that we expect of Hannibal Lecter. And it's very, very, you know, in one sense, it's quite satisfying to see him really taking action and really trying to bring it against Hannibal. And at the same time, it's really, really sad because it's the eternal tragedy of Will Graham yet again, of like how much like his prey does he have to become in order to really catch them. He's in a sense, he's dealing with the same thing that he was having to deal with in the first season, but that was more of from a psychological standpoint, you know, looking into these minds, how much is he sort of actually reflecting? And here it's more of conscious decision. How much is he going to have to, is he going to have to act like these people in order to put a stop to them? I'll let Edmund jump in here because I've been monologuing.
No, that's all right. It's completely understandable with this. I just wanted to pick up on this sense of Will as in a way, certainly given the outcome, being Hannibal Light, but certainly the trying to manipulate from behind bars was the direct shout out to those who do know the books more fully. But even of course when he's being brought to the crime scene, for those who only know Silence of the Lambs or even just some of the most iconic stills from it, I mean, having Will brought in on the hand truck with the mask, even if it's
yes,
clear, just to really point out the similarities.
Fuller has really talked a bit about in some of his interviews that he wants to do, you know, in the course later in the show of like directly adapting the books. He also wants these first three seasons to be kind of weird parallel shadow archetype things of the three books, which is why the first season is a lot like Red Dragon of Will, serial killers, and Hannibal help, but with a twist on it. And so this season is very much Silence of the Lambs, but with a big twist on it.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, the other wonderful addition was was having Gideon come back. I mean, certainly, you know, certainly Eddie Izzard created quite a stunning character of his own last season, and I actually found it quite believable, especially given Will's state that gunshot wound was not in fact fatal. It did stop him as intended, but we certainly knew what state Will was in. So if anybody was complaining that was a stretch, I would not agree with them. And certainly given just to have some more jousting between Will and another intelligent killer added a lot as well. And the reason I was saying Hannibal Light was that it for those who do know what the Hannibal backstory or story to come, he's pretty good at it, but he's not quite Hannibal level. I think we have even gotten a sense of that in the series, where it's never been spelled out, but exactly how he turned his doctor's attacker does seem to be the early hint within the series itself of just how quick and effective and manipulative he can be. Will certainly does his best, but it's certainly a bit of an irony that the fact that he's as grieving as they may be, the fact that he's going up against his own team, it doesn't quite work. It comes very, very close, and you know, you certainly get to see Hannibal in a state where it does look like he's about to die. But of course he
you know, no, he's not. He's really not going to die.
Oh, I know, but still, it would.
You mean the character that the show is named after is not going to die midway in the second season?
I never felt like the show was trying to convince me.
Oh no,
he was
no,
really in danger. They were making a point about the. If they mentioned the character's name, I've got to admit I completely missed it. But the orderly,
and
a lot of details of the orderly are actually drawn straight from the descriptions of Francis Dolarhyde in Red Dragon. The details of sort of how he talks and stuff, and the notion of where he talks about, you know, you spend enough time in a sanatorium and you pick up the drill, is a song Will Graham talked about in that. As is just the whole concept of one, you know, someone in prison sicking a killer who's free on their enemy.
Well, anything else to add to all of that? That was a heck of a start to the week, though. I mean, an episode that ranks up between the two of you at a 9.5, so certainly a high-scoring episode. Anything to add, or are we good with that one?
I think we're good.
All right, well, then we're going to go ahead then, and I'm going to do the rare thing and actually pick our next topic. I would like to talk about the Walking Dead finale. So, here's the promo.
Hyundai presents scenes from the season finale of The Walking Dead.
Sanctuary for all. Community for all.
For more video, go to AMC.com.
All right, and that would be The Walking Dead, Season 4, Episode 16, A. Not like Canadian, but, you know, A. In the Season 4 finale, Rick comes face-to-face with sheer brutality when multiple paths collide. That's certainly putting it one way, or as I said to a few
people. All those AMC writers, yes.
Yes.
It's not wrong.
Rick Grimes takes a bite out of crime. The best part is the lag.
From one show back animals to another.
Yes, that's right. That's why I figured it would be, you know, thematically pleasing anyway. But certainly I'd like to get everybody's scores on this one, and I wanted to hit this one early because I know that Bronstam had some comments that he wanted to make on this, and before, you know, the internet in Australia suddenly decides to stop working. Why don't you go ahead and give us your score, Bronstam?
See, I've managed to go back and rewatch the episode since I talked to you about it, and my score is significantly higher. I think I went up bumping it to... I bumped it up to an 8. I was close to bumping it up to a 9. It was just a couple of little things.
Okay. Gary, how about you?
I gave it a 9.
Okay. Edmund?
I will give it a 9 as well.
Okay, and that's a 9 for me, too. All right. Well, there we go. Oh, right. A good, strong ending to this season of The Walking Dead. So I don't think we need to talk about it at all after that, right? No. Okay. I'll give Bronstom, I know that you were a little bit less than favorable the first time around. So what was it about the second time around that kind of changed your tune? In brief, you know, maybe a couple of the main
points. I guess that what changed my mind was really not having expectations. I wasn't expecting it to be so focused on one group. I figured the notion was like we had a few people converging on Terminus. We have a chance to sort of see things from different perspectives and whatnot, have a bit of a catch up and a bit of a reunion. And that didn't really happen, but this time around I didn't really mind so much. I guess I just got a sort of renewed appreciation for the themes that were going on and the parallels between the facts and the present day storyline. And for one thing, also this time there was a line during the climax that I completely missed, which is where Rick's like, "Yeah, I think they're alive. They should get our feet."
Mm.
I missed that first time I watched. And I just assumed that these guys were all really, really terrible shots.
They were all stormtroopers.
Yeah, that was exactly what I thought. And if you assume that, it really takes the wind out of the sails of that whole final sequence.
No, and, if you, and, I'm sorry, because
yeah,
there's a
I guess.
Lag. But I was going to say, if you pay attention very closely, because I actually had to go back and watch it a couple times myself, because I wound up talking with some people about it at work who watched the show, and they wound up having to go back and watch it because of things that they missed. But as they're running around, you definitely get the sense that they're being herded to a certain spot. But as they run past other shipping containers, you can actually hear people in there screaming for help and trying to get people's attention. And if at some point when they run by, they stick on it just long enough for you to see it, but there is a caged off area where they have the remains of the bones of previous victims. So they don't even try to hide what the nature of Terminus is. It's all right there. It's just that they do it in such a way that it's not like, you know, let us beat you over the head with it. It's more like it really drove people to go back and look at it.
It's like the characters have made intentional efforts to try and hide this stuff, but now, like the Terminus characters, our protagonists have sort of like just peeked far enough behind the curtain that they can notice, you know, they can notice stuff. I can imagine that at this point the characters don't actually quite know what's going on. They might have suspicions or whatnot, but obviously they have the luxury of being able to go back and freeze frame and sort of stuff like that. I missed a couple of those details, but I did sort of pause them a bit with the mural with all the names on it and stuff like that. Just in general, I'm kind of imagining Nolan North to show up as the leader of guys with a really creepy beard, southern accent. They've left little mystery as to what these guys are about, but in this way.
Yeah. Now, Gary, how about you? Going out on a 9 with this one. So, what was your takeaway for this one?
No, I liked it a lot. I can't say that I'd give it a 10 because of sort of how it ended up. It's, you know, it seems to me more setup than resolution, although some people could argue getting everyone back was the resolution. But I don't view it as such, so I took off a little bit for that. That being said, I did notice that they were intentionally being herded into a location and caught the bones site pretty easily, although my wife, who was watching it at the time, missed some of those details as well. I don't know why I picked up on them. But it's interesting, you know, in the comic books, the place is called Sanctuary. And as John talks about being beaten over the head with it, using the name Terminus makes me, you know, think of Terminus, Terminal. Yeah, I get it. Okay. But I thought Sanctuary was from the comics would have been a little bit more ambiguous, perhaps. But that being said, it was nice that it got together. I think what this episode showed us was Rick will never be able to go back to who he was. He has, you know, permanently changed, you know, for better or worse. He's doing what he has to do to survive in this new world. And he can't go back anymore. As I think back of the season opener, as he's trying to put his gun down and be this sort of farmer type of guy, he's trying to go back to, you know, what he was like before to some extent. And at this point, I think we have to realize that that's never going to happen again. It just, it's not possible in this world. If you're like that, you're going to die. So I thought it was a sort of nice, as I think of his journey from the beginning of the season to where we are now, being locked into that to that rail car, of not so much his how he changed so much as he's sort of come to accept that's the way he's going to be from now on.
Mm. Edmund, how about you? Before I jump into
that's fine. I thought the opening act in particular was incredibly strong. Certainly, it helped that I mentioned during the last episode. My big fear was, oh no, the gang of thugs are just going to be besieging Terminus, and they're trying to smoke Rick out, just like the governor. And certainly, having it to turn like that right at the beginning, from that going from that opening of Rick, blood-soaked face slumped against the car, to then showing how that happened was certainly a shocking way to wind up that arc and bring them back together with Daryl and also showing Rick's turn and making it believable that they actually could, starting with that shocking tearing out of the neck, just like a walker, turn the tables on them, and actually come out of it alive. And then also the way they were intercutting it with those scenes from the prison, which I found it from the behind the scenes stuff, was stuff that they actually did bring Scott Wilson back for. That wasn't stuff they'd shot back when in the first half of the season. Apparently they told him, don't cut your hair, don't shave, keep it like it is for now. We promise there's a reason. And using that to show, as Gary was saying, that progression that Rick goes through. And I also liked, in terms of where they then wound up, providing that contrast between, yes, this is one way you could provide food for your family by tilling the soil and growing things, or of course there is this other way where you can just take advantage of the food that's made available to you.
So, yeah, I still kind of think that.
Hannibal approves.
Not real.
Yeah.
Good barbecue.
Yes, exactly.
Well, we're all saying this, but at the same time, they have never actually come out and said it.
No. They've not come out and said it, but really, really putting it in the point of view of the protagonists, of the characters who are only coming in. We're only coming in and seeing as much as they see. And it's only if we're really, really able to stop and pay attention to the details in that big chase sequence, whereas the characters themselves were, running for their life, that we've spotted all of these things. It's just like, yeah, I think this is going beyond just a bit of a, suggestion. Like, it seems pretty explicit when you look at things like that.
Yeah,
I would agree. The characters don't even necessarily know that at this point. They just need to know that something's wrong. Their friends have shown up and been stripped of their possessions.
And it's also in hindsight, of course, that little greeting mantra of, yes, when people arrive and become part of us, we get stronger. Takes on a whole different meaning, of course.
Well, yeah, and I was,
you put the food in your belly and you live.
I was gratified by how much was actually, again, how they take elements from the progression in the comic source material, and even though they got there in a very different way, ultimately they really hit on all the major points, leading up to this. As Gary said, it was called Sanctuary in the comics, but in here it's called Terminus. But then there is on the sign, those who arrive survive, sanctuary for all. So, I mean, it is kind of there, but you've got to... It's there for those who know what to look for, I guess you could say, even in retrospect. What really got me in this episode, and I really loved it, was the fact that Rick's whole thing with the group that Daryl winds up with and how that's all going down, it's really what we're seeing is Rick just accepting in that moment that it's about survival. It's about doing what it takes to survive. And who you can trust and really nobody else. And you build up all this, he's thinking back on this time when maybe it could have gone differently. And he's recognizing that it just is never going to happen that way. That's not the world they live in anymore. He has to do what it takes to protect Carl and the people that are with him. And we get to hear him justified by Michonne as he kind of, Carl is kind of reacting to this lesson and, you know, Michonne's big thing is that, okay, yes, we all have to act like monsters sometimes, but we come back. And then, you know, the audience at that point is conditioned, right? Because we're seeing Rick and we see him bite the guy's neck out and then stab the would-be rapist. And we're all sitting there like, yeah, yeah, go do what it takes to survive. And then we get to a place where ostensibly they are doing what they feel it takes to survive. The difference being that they've made a choice to be the monster and stay the monster. So there's a line that they've now drawn, but I love the fact that they take you down this road to really root for Rick and the fact that Rick is back. He's back to being the... And then it's like, oh, but his attitude is not all that different than the people that we find really reprehensible as soon as we realize what they were doing.
So, yeah, it is a return of formativeness, but it's tragic. It's not positive. It's not like, you know, Peter Parker quit and then becoming Spider-Man again or something like that. No, it's this regression. It's a relapse. It feels a lot more like that. But then at the same time, I felt like...
I was going to say, that's the reason why he was up against the car with his hands shaking. Go ahead. Sorry, there was a lag.
I felt like part of the point of the flashbacks was, and then that scene afterwards we're talking to Daryl, is that part of what it's trying to establish is that, yeah, they can make the choice, and that there are times where they're going to have to sort of become monsters in order to survive. But what we saw in the flashback was the path Rick went on to realizing that he could make a decision that, okay, we're in a place where I don't need to be the monster anymore. I can be a farmer. I can be a father. I can sort of be a more normal person and, you know, impart different lessons to his son and all that kind of stuff. And what I feel like we saw in this episode, really when he decides to sort of take on the leaders of the gang, is like him making the decision like, right, okay, I need to go back. I need to be the monster again. And I feel like we saw him make that decision again at the very end of the episode. I sort of take from it the notion like there is this part of him that does feel like it's relapsed and that sort of thing. And that, you know, at his core, like, yeah, there's not that much that makes him different to these people he just attacked, except that these people that he's just fought, they're living as the monsters, I felt like. They had this violence and this anarchy that was inherent in everything they do, and I feel like a lot of what we've seen this season is a Rick who can decide. Much like how we saw Michonne decide at the beginning, at the beginning of the second half of this season, she got back into the pattern of being the monster to survive, and then sort of realizes like, wait, no, I can choose. Don't just, it's not a it's not purely circumstantial. She can decide, you know, whether she, just because she's back in the wild and in sort of a tough situation and stuff like that, she doesn't have to sink so completely into it. I thought that was the great thing of her story when we came back with this year with the show. And yeah, that's sort of what I took from it, the notion that I'm trying to think of a... Yeah, I've rambled all over the place, but I feel like I haven't quite got the point across. Just the notion that he can make the decision, that he doesn't that he has changed the character, but part of that change is just accepting that, okay, sometimes he needs to be the monster, but then the rest of the time, sort of, he can be the more normal, restrained person. That it's not beyond his control.
What would we like to add to this? Do we need to add anything to this?
I like the Michonne revelation. I thought we'd been getting little bits and pieces of it, but I felt we really fleshed out a lot more of why she was, where she was, and how she was doing things. I thought that was interesting. Also, I thought it was pretty ambitious of Rick to sort of be on the offensive as they're all locked up in that kettle car. Oh, yeah. Oh, just wait for us now. Okay, you're all locked in a box without weapons. Okay.
Well, they know where to get weapons.
Rick just showed everybody he doesn't need weapons.
True. It's just like, right, monster time.
That's it.
Rick, smash.
I'm going to chew my way through this wall and, yeah.
Matter eater. Yeah.
I will say that I thought that the Walking Dead finale, like that climax, that last scene, was a little too much like the last episode of Black Sails, my liking. Again, I had this feeling like there was supposed to be another act break, like there's supposed to be another act or another episode after this one, and they just decided to shunt things to the next season, and it just felt unsatisfyingly abrupt.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I was actually thinking the same thing. That's actually what kept it for me from being a 10 and dropped it to a 9 for me was that sense that no, we're just chopping it off in the, you know, in really the middle of the beginning of this part of the story. I actually thought of it in my head, wondering if this trend now to everything having to be half seasons rather than even full seasons, if we're going to start calling it Black Sail Syndrome, when they don't really have quite enough time to finish off the story, and it's like, oh no, but we're going to leave you on a nice juicy cliffhanger for next time in a few months.
Not a good cliffhanger, okay. And that was my point. It's like a good cliffhanger, it sort of leaves you with an excitement for where the story is going next by giving you sort of the crumbs of how it's going to begin. And sort of leaving you with a sense of tension. It's like you're eager to come back and see what happens next in the story because, in a sense, they've started telling it. And admittedly, I'm almost describing what happened here, but there is just also a sense of tone and stuff. Like, still one of the best cliffhangers ever is... like to go on a bit of a tangent, still one of the best cliffhangers ever is Next Generation, Best of Both Worlds. And we wouldn't dispute that. The reason that that's an awesome cliffhanger is not because you had sort of Patrick Stewart show up and say, I'm a bad guy now, but because it finished on Rack saying, yeah, we're going to fight you anyway.
Yeah.
Like there's a difference, there's subtlety. And this...
Let me maybe give a number okay, one. For the most part, I agree, which is why I also gave it a 9. But I do have a slightly different interpretation. To me, this feels almost like they've patterned the half-season arcs, not unlike the way that Robert Kirkman has patterned the comic arcs in a very similar fashion, where... yes, it's clear that there's going to be more to the story, and sometimes you have a softer cliffhanger versus a harder cliffhanger, but this felt like, thematically for the season, this is where it had to end, because it started with Rick trying to not be who he was, and then it brought you full circle. So it felt like bringing them back together at Terminus, facing this new threat that we understand, even if the characters don't fully understand... it does lead into the next season, and I know a lot of people have felt completely different about, you know, the level of anticipation. But that's where I was reading it, was kind of that they were trying to replicate that feeling of the source material.
I can see that, like the notion that we end the season on a fully realized Rick, as opposed to one who was the one who began the season, who had found a measure of peace, but had also sort of found this measure of self denial.
Right. Exactly.
Like he wasn't at peace with himself, and now he sort of is. And the downside of that for the bad guys is that now you've got a guy who can love his son and wants nothing to do with violence, and in the same breath, tear your throat out with his teeth.
Mm-hmm. Well, and think of where the season hit the midpoint was with him trying to be that man of peace, but. That backfiring on him with that whole battle with the governor, and who was the main victim at that point, but his kind of guru in terms of taking the more peaceful way, which was Herschel. So it does hit those three points along the way, if you look at it from the point of view of Rick's arc. But I can understand why people would feel like it kind of teased the next thing and then it kind of left you hanging, which, I agree largely with that, and I would have given it a 10 otherwise, but... I think we've kind of hit everything here, unless, Gary, you wanted to add anything more?
No. I think you've summed it up well.
Okay. Well, let's see. I think it's time for a midpoint break. I'm trying to think of the best thing that we can hit here as we roll out of The Walking Dead. Maybe Don't Look Back by the Fine Young Cannibals? No, that's too on the nose. So I'll pick something a little bit less obvious. Stay tuned. All right, well, we are back, and you know, despite this being a all cannibal all the time show, apparently so far, Gary, maybe you can put us on a different path.
Well, we've been into a little blood, guts, and gore, so I say we should stay on that track and go with Helix.
All right, and here's the promo.
Many sacrifices were made in the pursuit of science.
Friday, on the season finale of Helix.
You don't know me.
They will hunt you to the end of the earth.
Not if I find them first.
The season finale of Helix. Friday at 10, only on Sci-Fi.
All right, and if you could do the recap...
Yes, we're talking about Helix. Season 1, Episode 13, Dans el Hombre. In the Season 1 finale, Alan and Walker battle with the Scythe to save the world from disaster.
The Scythe. Yes. Yeah, this was a... this was... Well, okay. What would you give this one, do you think?
Does our scale extend into negative numbers?
No. But we can give half points going forward. I forgot to mention that.
No. Oh, that would have changed every score I've ever given. No. I will actually give it a 6.
Okay. And Bronstone, how about you? Oh, we're not talking about cannibals anymore, so he's not here. Oh, well. We knew that was going to happen. Oh, he didn't watch it. That explains it. He just sent me a text. Edmund.
I'm here.
Edmund?
I'll give it a 5.
A 5, okay. And I'm going to give it a 6, I guess. Yeah, I guess so. And I just got done saying I could do halfsies, but 6 is fine. All right, so, I guess for me, I wound up writing up, and it didn't go up yet, as far as I know, before this episode goes out on the thing, but a season recap for Helix. And my main thing was that what was the damn point of the entire first season? because, quite frankly, it feels like to me that the whole first season was nothing but a vehicle to deliver the exposition for what the show was really going to be about. Which was this battle against the Corporation of Immortals trying mm-hmm. to take over the world. Does that sound at all like the show that we started watching 13 episodes ago? Just throwing it out there. But
no.
No.
No, not at all.
Yeah, and quite frankly, like I said, it now makes me backtrack and think, if the whole point was... What was the whole point? What was Sataki trying to do? If he was trying to keep Ilaria from getting the virus and the cure, there's a really easy way to do that. Destroy it.
Yes.
If he just wanted to have a cure just long enough in order to give it to the people that he wanted it for, and then destroy it, did he need to stage an outbreak scenario for to get the CDC people that just happened to be the loved ones of the people at the base? It's like this whole thing does not hang together at all. The incident that brought them down or up there to the Arctic in the first place makes absolutely zero sense when you go back and look at how this whole first season emerged. Am I wrong? I mean, did I lose something along the way? Gary.
Well, you know, if you try to make sense of this, all just sort of jokes aside, I guess Hataki wasn't able to get the cure and he needed help to do it. And he thought that maybe this might be a way to make it happen without Ilaria getting too suspicious that he brought down the CDC people. So that's was sort of my, at least where I think they were trying to go. And
okay.
So under that, I could almost sort of see some of the things, obviously.
And I understand
that. Out of, you know,
yeah, you're half-heartedly away. Trying to explain this on their behalf, which is kind of unfair because I don't think you actually believe what you're saying either. But
well, as I try to make sense of it, this is what, you know, I said, yeah. Okay, well, I see. This piece here and this piece here. So I think what they meant was
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
But again, I still have the sense that there was no real cohesive plan to get us to this final episode.
No, right. and that explanation makes sense at this end of the season, but the way Hataki was acting in the first few episodes, that doesn't make sense at all.
Oh, no, and I don't agree with that it makes sense even now, because think about it. This guy had decades to develop the virus, and he created a cure for everything else. And then the CDC walks in and within the space of 12 days, no, about 10 days, comes up with a cure for it.
Yeah.
Really? That, sure, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, you're right. It might have made sense if they'd actually been able to pull off looking like brilliant scientists, but they just look completely hapless most of the time.
Yes.
Or one of them looked fairly competent, but of course she got killed off early on. But...
Oh, no, because the cure was effectively found by a person who was suffering from delusions at the time. And dying, by the way. It's like, what? This whole thing just, it did not hang together well at all. The only thing that really raised it up to a 6 for me was the fact that I think the show that they turned it into now actually isn't half interesting. I mean, or half bad. I mean, it is interesting, the idea that these characters are now arrived at this other kind of place in terms of where the story is, but... And it is somewhat bold to set your entire season up at this facility and then, and not just metaphorically, but literally blow it up, making a very firm statement that the show going forward is not going to be the show that you were watching. I kind of dig that, but this smacks so much of the third season of Battlestar Galactica. Starts off with a lot of potential and just goes all over the map, and by the last episode completely rechanges everything and you just are left going, what?
Yeah,
at least it was a good way. You were saying what, but
yeah. I mean, one thing that got to me was once it became clear that this was all just prologue, it really felt like no, this should have gone the BSG or Walking Dead route in terms of the beginning of no, just have this be a little 4 to 6 episode miniseries just to set things up and wet people's appetite, you hope, for the big story to come. But stretching it out for 13 episodes just meant they had a lot of time to fill.
And a lot of opportunity to screw up the storytelling in the process. Yeah, I definitely agree. I would even say that it was a fairly competent cast, except for that they were sometimes given material that they clearly had no way to sell. And, I mean, Billy Campbell's good, but there's only so much you can do when your character is basically forced to look like an idiot.
I disagree. He was one of the, I had a very hard time with his acting throughout this whole season. It was very rough.
Not just because he was dumb.
No,
I'm looking in terms of his career. He's pretty good. I don't know what it is about this particular character, but I'm thinking back to like the 4400 and other shows that he's been on, and he's been perfectly fine. I don't know if this just isn't the kind of character that he excels at playing, but then I don't think that the writing's been particularly good. I don't think any of the characters have been well served by the writing. I mean, Hitaki is basically just, you know, I hate to say it in this somewhat insensitive way, but it's basically like a fortune cookie, you know, generator. Half of his dialogue is just blathering. He's not saying anything. And then as soon as they ask him a question that is absolutely pertinent, he knows the answer. He just sits there and stares at everybody. I mean, it's terrible writing no matter how you look at it, because it's like you said, Edmund, it's 3 or 4 episodes worth of storytelling stretched out over 13 episodes. And you can see where the filler is. And that's where I have the issue with it, is that it clearly was prologue and it easily could have been, like you were saying, a 2-hour pilot. Just to kind of get the ball rolling, get things going, and then move on to the next phase, which would be the real show, which is apparently not going to be at this facility in the Arctic, but instead, France. So...
Actually, you know, I looked and they did that flash to day 235. I actually did the math. That would mean that they have 18 seasons of this show.
No.
That's what I said. God, no.
I'm surprised it got renewed. And there's a couple reasons why I'm surprised it got renewed. First of all, I looked at the ratings and they're not. And let's go back to another show that was kind of ratings challenged, Alphas. The ratings for Helix Season 1 are below the ratings for Alpha's Season 1. And I remember that renewal was surprising to a lot of people. There was speculation that they based the renewal off of the first few episodes that had much higher numbers than the later part of that first season of Alpha's. So I'm just thinking, okay, is this again one of these situations where the first season was almost cheap for sci-fi to run? And they still got the name recognition of Ron Moore being the executive producer and the one behind it all, and they can still use that a bit. There are people out there that really enjoyed the show. I I haven't exactly been able to suss out what they're seeing differently necessarily, other than they just kind of like the camp more than we do. But I think that this could easily be an Alpha situation where, unless they somehow, when in this kind of rebooting that they're doing, manage to pull in a lot more people, I can easily see this only being a 2-season show. But there we are. I mean, Helix was a show that had a lot of potential going in, but I feel like it squandered it big time, and it currently stands as the third worst scored show out of all of them this season. So out of, I guess it ranks number 38 out of 40.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that tell you? The two shows that rank below it are Falling Skies Season 3 and Star-Cross Season 1. Yeah. That's your comparison, folks. All right, well, that all being said, Edmund, give us the next topic for us to close this one.
Yes, well, let's go from finales to the Season 3 premiere of Continuum.
Oh, boy. All right, let's run that promo.
My name is Kira Cameron, and I came here from the year 2077.
That's 2012.
Who is this?
How are you on my computer?
How are you in my head?
You're Alex Sadler.
It's impossible.
Where is here?
How did we get back?
How do I get home?
You are home.
The war begins now.
He loves you.
I love you too.
You'll stay on the contract.
I have to accept the truth. Please don't hurt her. It doesn't mean I have to stop trying.
Emily!
You let him manipulate you. You let him use you. Alex Sadler.
I'm sorry, Kira.
I can go home. That's all I've ever wanted.
I'm Catherine. I'm the keeper of this cell. We are simply guardians of the school. For you, it means you can return to your family.
Where is Alec?
We have to get moving. We're losing our window of opportunity.
There has to be another way.
I will fix this.
Okay, and if you could do the recap for us.
This is Continuum, Season 3, Episode 1, Minute by Minute. In the Season 3 premiere, Kira puts everything on the line and her trust in the mysterious group as she races to stop Alec, who's trying to save Emily from altering history. And I would rate this as a 9.
Mm-hmm. And Bronstone, did you happen to see this one? Are you still there? Oh no, did we lose him? Let's see. Did he send me that too?
We might have.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, Gary, how about you? What would you give this one?
Jeez, I'm going to go with a 9. I almost feel like they rebooted the whole series with this episode. It's that drastic a change for me.
You're not wrong. That's for sure. Yeah, I would give it a 9 as well. I thought this was great. And Edmund, why don't you get us started a little bit? What are your highlights for this one?
Sure. Well, the big thing, I mean, as Gary said, I mean, this really was taking the concept and just, I mean, rebooting it, upping the ante, obviously making it much, much more complex, but still doing it with that strong foundation in hard science fiction and good time travel mechanics and explanations there does tend to be a certain amount, a little bit of hand waving when you're introducing alternate timelines, but I really liked the grittiness and the way they brought it in without it just being, oh, just something that happens and you have to go back and fix it, giving it real hard consequences and something that's a very bad and nasty thing that's happened that has to be corrected. So the whole idea of having to send her back into the timeline to correct it, but doing it in a way where it's not the old Star Trek way of the Bureau of Temporal Investigation rolling their eyes about the latest Kirk mess up they have to fix. No, this was still in keeping with the sort of got to the show, and then her winding up having to make some very, very, very difficult decisions, and just setting up this whole new set of conflicts with what you think as the episode progresses with two of each of them running around and her having to decide which Alec is going to bring back her future, which is going to bring back a different future, and as far as I'm concerned, it's still up in the air over which future is the better one, and I'm still very intrigued to see if this series is moving eventually. It won't be soon, but to that point where will she have to decide to give up her future for a better future for everyone else? But the fact that they actually managed to set things like that up and do it so well is just really wonderful to see.
Yeah. Gary, what do you want to add to that?
Oh, no, I agree. And it's not only that, but I love the, as Edmund said, this is time travel dirty. You know, you have multiple of the same person interacting almost with each other at some points, or at least cleaning up the other's body. And it's I love that it's that ambiguous, non-clean time travel type of story. I think at this point, I think it has diverged, and as we listen to the the time travel people, they talk about they know it's different, they accept it's different, and generally they don't even like to time travel at all. Even though they get into hard science fiction facts, like they sent somebody way back in the past with a copy of the history so they know what things are supposed to be like. I love the setup a lot. Kira is almost being played as a different character than we've come to have know her by. This Kira now, I guess maybe now that the stakes are so much higher, is a much less touchy feely type of person. It seems that she's being played as a much more cold and calculating individual. And I sort of like that change as things go up. We see Liberate is still in the game, but in some ways they almost seem petty given all the severe issues of trying to keep the timeline back on track. Their little terrorist things, to me, unfortunately, at this point, start to pale. Before this reboot, they seem much more sinister. Now I'm not seeing them in quite that light anymore.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right that she's definitely shifted in terms of personality, and I wonder how much of that is her sense of betrayal by the person that she probably trusted the most. And yet, now that she is working for the freelancers to some degree in order to try and quote-unquote repair things, it really, like you said, it's almost like they rebooted the show in a way. And I kind of like that fact. They're not resting on their laurels. They're still telling the story in the same universe, and in a way they're still remaining right in the continuity that they had already created. All they're doing is kind of widening the perception a bit. And that's an exciting thing to see them do. And just the way that they can now play things, it just really changes things up a lot. It's a very interesting direction for them to take. And it's challenging the audience in a way, but at the same time, I think this is probably the cleanest version of this kind of mixed timeline storytelling that I've seen in a while. It didn't feel confusing when I was watching it. It's a little hard to explain, maybe, but when you're watching it, you have a really good sense of who's who and what's going on and so on. So,
well, they did have either the bloody scar or the dirt mark,
yeah,
to help us keep characters.
But I think that the tone of the characters was different too. I mean, like you said, that you can tell which Alec it is even if you're not looking at whether or not there's a blood stain on their forehead. I mean, that is a very nice visual thing, but there's a different edge to him in the post, Emily's death attitude. And the desperation that's on it, in his character, he really feels like a completely different person. Even if it's a very
and I almost
difference.
Question that to some extent, because I realize that he's going back in time to save Emily, but at least with the Alec character, it seems like he's changed so much in what amounts to a day and a half. His stretch seems a little bit more for me than.
But we've also had indications that when you travel through time, the more that you do it, it has effects on you mentally. And I'm wondering if we're also supposed to be picking up on that. Because there were weren't there certain hints in the second season that Kira was not quite was perhaps suffering from the effects, and certainly one of the Liberate members was having severe issues, if I remember correctly. So I'm wondering if they're trying to set something up there, but I guess we'll find out. Anything we want to add here? Because we are running slightly long.
No, just bring on more.
I would agree with that. Gary, any last thoughts on Continuum?
Oh no, I'm looking forward to this. I've been waiting for this show to come back for a while now. It seemed like forever, so I really like the change. If you were getting sort of complacent with the show, believe me, they've shaken everything up. give it a look again. And if you didn't like version one of this show, we're in version two now. Give it another shot.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and we're going to go out then on what is still our usual closing, but don't worry, I'll be updating that soon enough. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...